Charles Nolte, Billy Budd and Beyond, is a tribute to an extraordinary man.
Dr. Nolte was one of those people that when he walked in the room, you couldn't help but notice him because he had that amazing presence about him.
He was an exceptional journal writer for a number of years, particularly during his time on Broadway. And really, those journals provide insight to a gay actor living in New York in the 1950s, which is a time that a lot of historians haven't really been looking at yet.
When he was honored at the Treader Collection and he read from one of his journals,
yes.
It was just astounding. Not only did he read it excellently, but it was such good writing.
Charles was also a scholar of Strindberg and Ibsen, and he had a really good insight about how they changed our views of sexuality and gender. And I think nowadays people kind of forget about those two major playwrights, but he was an expert on those two.
50 or 60 years, I've kept a journal, and sometimes I've kept it day by day when I was in an interesting play like Caine Mutiny.
He originated the title role in Billy Budd in 1951.
We wanted to write something for Charles. Charles was my first playwriting teacher.
He'd been out all those years where there were a lot of people that were on Broadway, you know, even the critics wouldn't talk about the homosexual characters.
Charles was an actor, a director, a playwright, a teacher at the University of Minnesota for over 30 years, and really had a huge impact on the local theater community in Minnesota.
Charles, how old are you?
84. You're just a child.
No.
I don't consider 84 that old.
Charles Nolte was born on November 3rd, 1923, in Duluth, Minnesota. He was a distinguished theater artist with an international reputation, an actor, playwright, director, and educator who taught at the University of Minnesota for over three decades. He graduated in Wayzata High School in 1941. He studied at the University of Minnesota for 2 years, then served in the United States Navy from 1943 to 1945. Upon his return, he enrolled at Yale University and then embarked on a career that would touch many people's lives in the years to come. In 2008, he shared his life experiences with KFAI Fresh Fruit hosts Dixie Treichel and John Townsend.
My first production in New York, which was, as I was saying, in Catherine Cornell's production of Antony and Cleopatra, with some very great actors. Now, when she mounted Antony in 1946-47, she hired, because they were just out of the army or whatever, these young guys. I was one of them. One of them was Charlton Heston, Eli Wallach, Maureen Stapleton, Tony Randall. They were all appearing in a Broadway production for the first time. She wanted to bring in the young people. Well, you know, some of these are great names. Julie Harris would have been in it, except she was luckily in another play.
You know, you were Billy Budd on Broadway in 1951. That has raging homoerotic and homoromantic subtext.
Well, of course it does have that, but how would you find that out if you read the text at the time? The young man is a figurehead, basically, since he can't speak correctly. I mean, he has a speech impediment. He doesn't have to say much at all, but there's no question in the book, certainly, if you read Melville's book, it's rank with all of that sort of thing. But the fact that when that play came on in New York, 1951, even before in the 49, in the first version, which was called Uniform of Flesh, in which I also appeared, there were 9 metropolitan daily newspapers at that time. But all 9 theater critics could go through, give this play, this is in 50-51, wonderful reviews without ever mentioning the word homosexuality.
Wow.
In my case, plays that I've been in on Broadway, almost all of the directors were gay, but did anybody know it? Of course not.
Mm-hmm.
There's a degree of attempt to hide something which within another 20 years nobody bothered to hide at all.
Right, right.
Look what happened to Rock Hudson, my God.
You were friends with Tennessee Williams as well.
I was, and Tennessee was one of the very first, you see, to break the barrier. Although even he, because Kazan didn't want that particular aspect of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof emphasized, but it's absolutely clear in the text, and it's certainly clear in Tennessee's mind, that the relationship between Brick and his fellow football player was a homoerotic situation. Mm-hmm. But did anyone come out and say that? Not in so many words, and yet there it is. It strikes me as so absurd today, looking back, at how blinkered we all were.
After his acclaimed role in Billy Budd, Charles began work on The Caine Mutiny Court Martial, a play that ran for 2 years in Los Angeles before going to Broadway. He would work with Henry Fonda for the second time, but the play would have a surprise twist in directors.
Charles Laughton ultimately ended up directing, who was of course gay. Dick Powell began directing, he was a producer, Paul Gregory hired him. And can you imagine, he had this huge, potentially enormous hit, and he hires this Hollywood actor who had never directed a play in his life. And within 2 weeks of the rehearsal, everybody in the cast knew that it was impossible. It was a case of total disaster where Laughton, sitting in the back, is a great friend of Paul Gregory, the producer. He wasn't about to see his producer friend end up with a $2 million fiasco. And he says, you've got to get rid of that guy. And I don't mean tomorrow or next week. I mean tonight. Charles Laughton took that script and with one day he cut it in half. And he so terrorized most of the actors in it, including myself, that many of them quit. They could not stand the pressure. My own experiences with Laughton, when he tried to figure out what to do with me as the character playing Willie Keith, he knew Billy Budd, so obviously he knew what my image was. But he subjected me to a crucial couple of nights by his swimming pool of most extraordinary psychotherapy. All to the good, because I think it did help me a lot. But in the journal I kept through the entire Caine Mutiny Court Martial period, I've got marvelous stories of the furious and angry tirades back and forth between Laughton and Fonda.
Charles would also work with Lydia Clark and Charlton Heston, who he shared the stage with several times.
I liked Lydia a lot, and she was a very good actress, and I knew both Charlton, because Charlton and I roomed together in two Broadway shows, and I knew them very well. I always considered her by far the better actress of the two, and indeed she was. Heston was like acting with a refrigerator. and the clanging of bells and the great voice of his. It's like your prison gates shutting and opening. But Lydia, I think she liked me because I got her a job once, because I referred her to somebody in New York, and through Maynard Morris, the agency. She always credited me. But when they went to Hollywood, which they did immediately after the second play in which both Charlton and I appeared, Designed for a Stained Glass Window, she never acted again. But when I knew Charlton, he was not absorbed with the National Rifle Association. But he was a very interesting man. I kept seeing Heston all through his life because, you know, we would run into each other here, there, and yon. But I'll miss him.
For Charles, the New York theater had run its course. He went to Europe to live and act, where he saw new plays that would ignite his mind and imagination. Forever changed by these experiences, when he returned to the United States, he would begin a new career towards teaching.
And then I went to Europe and spent 7 years. Real education began. When I was making a movie in Berlin in the 1960s, and Jeff Chandler was in it, and Martine Carroll, and I'd been living in Berlin because I was working there, and the movie was called 10 Seconds to Hell. And here were these three great American and one French actors, actresses, sitting in their hotel, and then not one of them would take the trouble to go across. The wall hadn't even gone up yet in Berlin to see the Berliner Ensemble in its original home on the Schiffbauer Damm and see those great Brechtian productions as Brecht, who just had died with his wife, Helene Weigel, in the plays. And the more I spent in Europe, particularly in Berlin and in Munich and even in London, I saw how parochial the New York theater was. It's rooted in realism. Any idea about how to do anything in the absurdist tradition of theater, the modern isms in the theater, and I'd seen all of these things brilliantly in the Brecht theater in Berlin and so forth. So I said, what's my point in coming back and saturating myself in something that could be done at the Olog Theater? I'm out of here. I'm going into the academe racket, which very fortunately I did just at the time that Dr. Guthrie came here in 62. So in many ways, I had a very fortuitous life in that sense that I came back at the right time, having already accreted a certain number of credentials, both in film and in the in the theater, and by that time as a playwright as well. And then subsequently, with the help from the university, I began another career as a director and as a librettist. So I've had it all. I can't imagine anybody being as lucky as I've been.
Is it correct to say you were one of the founders of the Playwrights Center?
Yes, because they were all in my class, as
right.
Roy was.
Right.
And some of them, Barbara Field, you know, and
sure.
they decided after they graduated, we should continue our class. So we did it in Barbara's kitchen for a while, and mm-hmm. gradually it did evolve, largely with the help of Waring Jones, who just mm-hmm. recently died, as you mm-hmm. probably know,
right.
because he did fund it. He bought them that building where they are now.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I feel very proud of that, the wonderful organization.
You wrote a play about Strindberg called A Night of the Black Pig.
Yes, I did.
Which really looked a lot at sexuality and gender and misogyny and all that. And I really enjoyed the production done about 5 years ago at Theater in the Round.
That was one of my most successful plays because mm-hmm. it used a great many of the theater techniques, production mm-hmm. techniques that I'd learned by watching the Brecht Theater in Berlin
mm-hmm.
and so forth.
What year was that play written?
The first version, I think about 77, 78.
Okay.
And
mm-hmm.
then it was done subsequently in New York and then also in Belgrade, of all places. The problem with a play like that, you've got about 30 characters in the play and a small onstage band. Who's going to afford that?
Mm-hmm.
That's the one thing that is so distressing to me. The theater's shrunk largely because economics has forced it to shrink. We're living in very interesting times because so much is changing.
Charles was not only friends with Tennessee Williams, but he knew his work very well, directed all of his plays, and then there was the time Tennessee came to Minnesota.
Tennessee Williams, and I remember in class at one point you felt there was a time when, like, Night of the Iguana was kind of the end of a certain kind of great playwriting in America.
Well, I do consider that his last great play,
mm-hmm.
and I think that is a great play.
Yeah.
I've directed all of his plays at one time or another.
Is that right?
And one of my most heartwarming, memorable experiences in my career, of course, is when he came out here to see my production of Streetcar at the University of Minnesota with Deborah Mooney playing the part.
Mm.
And Deborah was then, I think, all of 21, but she was remarkable, and he knew it. And in fact, a year later, in the New York Times, Sunday section, Arts and Leisure, there was an article by Tennessee Williams in which he said, you know, the best Blanche DuBois I ever saw, except for Arletty in Paris. He didn't understand French, so he didn't know what she was doing. Was Deborah Mooney in a student production of Streetcar at the University of Minnesota.
That's
and the night he came to see it, and I was absolutely convinced that he never would make it to the theater because he, you know, his suitcase, which I lifted off the rack at the airport, was a lot of glass in there. His bottles, he was afraid this was a dry state. I was convinced that he'd be dead drunk in the Radisson under an assumed name. No, no, he came and he saw, and then he came to my house for the cast party. Can you imagine? Here he is sitting on the floor in the living room while drinking, cold duck or whatever it was. All these kids clustering around, and then suddenly at 3 a.m. he gets up and goes to the telephone in the kitchen. He's calling his agent in New York. Oh, Billy, I've discovered the real Blanche DuBois. I know it's 3 a.m. Billy.
At the age of 84, Charles would star in the new play, Exit Strategy, written by Roy Close and Bill Siemens. That was written with Charles in mind, along with Bill Siemens and Shirley Bernard.
What I find most interesting from my personal point of view, what mm-hmm. other play has been written in this century, or indeed in any century, where you have a major part written for a man in his 80s? Can
mm-hmm.
you think of any? I mean, King Lear was 60. Willie Loman is
60. 63, yeah.
James Tyrone is 65, according to the script. What is, to me, most attractive about being in the Exit Strategy, it's a new play.
Yeah.
It's not a regurgitation of, you know, here, look at the New York Times today. What, they're going on and on and on about South Pacific and Fannie Mae. Like, how many times do we have to see Miss Lapone in Gypsy? We've had three. It's ridiculous. Where are the new plays?
We wanted to write something for Charles, and having the people that we wanted to write for, which is a tremendous advantage, incidentally, being able to hear Charles's voice when you're writing the words that the character is going to speak. So it evolved in that fashion.
Well, you have to go through an epiphany. the characters have to decide whether or not they're going to take this journey, but they both eventually do decide to. And it turns out, I think, extraordinarily interestingly for them, the exit strategy that they adapt is far more interesting than the one that you normally think of, people who are at the end stage of their lives. So it's an optimistic view of old age. The two characters who most need help obviously have been stimulated by an electric shock treatment, which sends them out a good deal richer than when they started, and with a new view of life and a new appreciation of what old age can mean.
Mm-hmm.
So it's optimistic. Yeah. That's the only play I've ever heard of where old age is treated in this fashion. No attempt at using subterfuges of any kind. He's openly gay. He speaks of his experiences. Mm-hmm. He gets drunk at a gay bar and comes in, and there's no question about what he's been doing and where he's been and what effect it has on him.
He's made an unsuccessful pass at another man. And
he's slandered and attacked as often as would happen because of his age, basically. He's an old queen, you see. Mm-hmm. He can't keep his hands to himself.
He says that, and it's very touching in a way that he has this self-awareness. The other tenant, May, played by Shirley Vannard, is a fairly devout Catholic, and although she has a very complex and interesting relationship with Charles' character, she does not approve of the fact that he's gay. And when they argue, which they do frequently, that's one of the points of argument. She really thinks that he's going to hell for it. But on the other hand, They get along.
They made an arrangement. Mm-hmm. And there's no question about we're not living in a police state. We're not afraid any longer of admitting our roles in life.
Charles's character says, when he's asked what would he like to do, and he talks about he'd like to act again, and he talks about the thrill of standing in the wings on opening night, and you look down into the abyss, and then you jump.
Mm-hmm.
And that really, I think, is for most of us this play is about.
Dr. Charles Nolte passed away on January 14th, 2010, at the age of 86.
He describes gay subculture in New York at the time. He describes a lot of really amazing plays that he saw, which is, from a theater history standpoint, mm-hmm. it's a wonderful experience.
Mm-hmm.
He saw The Glass Menagerie in Chicago before it ever opened on Broadway. The journals are really at the core of this collection, which also includes his lecture notes for over mm-hmm. 30 years of teaching at the U, personal photographs, his manuscripts as a playwright and as a writer. It's an extensive collection that, mm-hmm. that really documents his life.
God, I bet those lecture notes are fascinating.
Really wonderful, yeah. And cover so many different topics from American theater to theater history, introduction to theater. He also was the one who started the drama and the media program at the U.
And he's an excellent writer. I went to when he was honored at the Treader Collection last mm-hmm. year, and he read from one of his journals.
Yes.
It was just astounding. Not only did he read it excellently, but it was such good writing. It was more like he was writing a book
yes.
than a journal.
That particular reading was of his coming back to the University of Minnesota to start graduate school in the 1960s after having quite a large career already on the stage. On our website, www.noltecollection.org, there's also a entry of his premiere on the Broadway stage in Antony and Cleopatra with Catherine Cornell.
Wow.
It's a beautiful entry. Quirky, lots of things happened that night, and he was also sharing the stage. It was a small part, but one of his co-stars was in the small mm-hmm. role as well, mm-hmm. Charlton Heston.
He was my professor in the early 80s.
He was my professor in the mid-60s. I was fortunate enough to take a series of playwriting courses, one of which he taught at the university in, I think, 1964. And he must just have arrived there.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And that was the University of Minnesota.
At the University of Minnesota. The class we met in Falwell Hall, and Charles was young and fresh and lively. And I remember that we read one of his scripts in class, which was actually the first play reading that I'd ever attended. Mm-hmm. And it was Do Not Pass Go, which later went to Broadway.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm. Charles was also a scholar of Strindberg and Ibsen, and he had a really good insight about how they changed our views of sexuality and gender.
Yes, and he was just very knowledgeable generally about the theater. He devoted his life to it, and by that time, you know, he had a 20-some year acting career and had really done a lot of very interesting work. You read lists of the people that he had performed with, and it's just kind of amazing. Charles was just a delight to work with. Here's a man in his early 80s, and you would think that he would be very comfortable settling down and taking it easy. And Charles, of course, loved, you know, to go to the theater, to go to concerts, and to travel and to entertain his friends. So he had a very active social life, and yet he really set it down, and he went back on the stage, and he worked extremely hard. We had, a four-week rehearsal period in a rehearsal studio and then in the theater. I've seldom seen people of any age work as hard as he did to get the character, to get the lines. And as a man in his early 80s, he was concerned about his memory. And one of the really entertaining things about this production was finding the various places that Charles had written his cues. You would find keywords sort of on the backside of the set to remind him what was the first word that was coming out of his mouth when he came on stage. And we had this great model. And the character of James was, in some respects, but not all, based on Charles as a person. The thing that was so true about him was he was very open about his sexuality. But he does it, of course, in ways in the play that are startling or shocking from time to time. But it never seemed to us, and I think it never really came across as anything other than a very natural thing. This is who this character is. And because we were writing it for Charles, we felt we could do that. And as you may know, there's a particular monologue that James has in the play when he describes, as a young man, having gone to the beach. He doesn't say so, but he was cruising, and he was living in New York, and he sees another man, and the other man may or may not see him, but the other man goes for a swim and actually goes walking along the edge of the water and disappears from view. And James, the character, describes how he goes to the other man's towel and takes the other man's clothing and puts it on and wears it home. What's really fascinating about this is that it's a true story, and it was Charles's story. Charles, as I'm sure you know, kept a journal for many, many, many years. And we had written a little speech for him. The subject of the scene was theft, stealing things. And we had written a speech for him, and he really didn't think it was appropriate. And so he brought in a 5-page excerpt from his journal. And this took place, I believe, in 1948. So he would have been about 24 years old. He had moved to New York, and he was just trying to break into the New York theater scene. He was just an absolute trooper right up to the end. And at the end of 4 weeks of performing, he was tired, and I believe it was the following week that he went to the doctor and learned that he had prostate cancer. So it was his swan song, and both Bill and I feel very grateful that we had the opportunity to give him the chance to make that.
My name is Eric Leary. I work for the Charles Nolte Collection for the Performing and Cinematic Arts at the Treader Collection. The Charles Nolte Collection, right now it's his personal papers, and in 2009 he donated his papers to the Treader Collection. They were about 97 boxes altogether, and they include his personal journals, his films, all of his manuscripts for the different writings, correspondence, photographs, all those things. That donation that Charles made is serving as a seed for a larger collection within the Treader Archive on gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender film and theater materials. One of his goals, especially later in life, was to take the journals that he had been writing over a period of about 20 years when he was in Hollywood and on Broadway, and to edit them and organize them into something that could be published. He got sick before he was able to see the first of those projects through. And when I started working with him, that became a project that both he and I were working on. This first journal set is from his time in the Caine Mutiny Court-Martial, which was based off of a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel that was on Broadway from 1953 to 1955. He starred in production with Henry Fonda and a gentleman who would later be known as James Garner. It was an incredibly successful production, and his journals reflect not only what it was like to participate in the rehearsal process and the long run of this amazing play during the golden age of Broadway, really, one of the most interesting and exciting times of Broadway. It also documents the life of a gay man living in New York in the 1950s, going to bars, meeting people, getting to know people in theater and in opera backstage. And in that way, the journals are incredibly interesting. incredibly powerful insights into a period that we really don't have a lot of personal material about, particularly from a gay perspective. In that year that we were meeting every week, a lot of what we talked about was the journals and where to take them and how to edit them, what to bring back. So what I've been working on is making those edits, making those changes and corrections, and also writing an introduction to the journal and getting it in a ready state for publication, which we're hoping to place with a publisher by the end of the summer.
Back in 91-92, I was one of the house managers for Steppenwolf Theater Company, and Stephen Eich, who was the general manager and the director of the play, A Summer Remembered, which I think, Eric, wasn't it that one of his earlier plays he wrote?
It was one of his earlier ones. It was originally titled The Summer People. It opened in London in 1962 at the Pembroke Theater. His partner, Terry, actually directed it.
And Stephen Eich, who was one of his students here at the university, directed it. Mm-hmm. And Randall Arney, who was the artistic director at Steppenwolf at the time, is now the artistic director at the Geffen Playhouse. So, you know, you see, here's this one man and the ripples of his
yes.
life
mm-hmm.
that continue sure. to affect mm-hmm. professional theater all across this country.
Eric, what was it like to work with Charles?
It was an amazing experience. I met him, it would have been just over a year ago, it would have been March of 2009, when we first started collecting his papers, coming over to his house and picking things up. Starting that week of March, I met with him every week until he passed away last January. It was an incredible experience. I consider him a good friend and a mentor even in that short period of time. Incredibly smart, incredibly generous with his time and with his energy. He was quite ill when I met him with cancer, but even in advanced stages of cancer, he still had an incredible enthusiasm. It really was a gift. I've learned more from him about theater and film and the history of them in the United States in the 1 year that I've known him than I have in the 8 years that I've been studying theater and film at a university. Really a remarkable, remarkable man that I'm happy to have known.
So I've had it all. I can't imagine anybody being as lucky as I've been.
Charles Nolte will be remembered for his many contributions to international and Minnesota theater and culture. He was a man of many theatrical talents and especially loved mentoring young people in theater. Charles Nolte is a Minnesota legacy who will continue to teach with all the memories, stories, and writings he has left us. He is survived by two sisters and his partner of over 50 years, Terry Kilburn. Voices heard on Charles Nolte, Billy Budd, and Beyond are Dr. Charles Nolte, Dixie Treichel, John Townsend, Eric Coleri, Roy Close, Shamey Kramer. This is Dixie Treichel for KFAI.
Funding for Miniculture on KFAI comes from listeners like you and the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.